It is Monday, September the 3rd. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, U.S. stops funding U.N. help for Palestinian refugees.
In the longer run, the implication of this is to call into question the whole idea of the status of Palestinian refugees 70 years later.
A 9-year-old American helping the poor in Bangladesh.
I basically learned it. No matter how much stuff you have, no matter how educated you are, that inside everyone's basically the same person.
Also ahead, scallop fights and tracking animal species, plus something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The U.S. is stopping its funding of a key U.N. agency. That story now from AP's Mike Gracia.
The Trump administration is ending decades of United States funding for the United Nations agency that helps Palestinian refugees. In a written statement, the State Department announced Friday that the U.S. will no longer commit further funding to this irredeemably flawed operation. The decision cuts nearly $300 million of planned support, and it came a week after the U.S. slashed bilateral aid for projects on the West Bank and Gaza. The U.N. agency provides health care, education, and social services to Palestinians in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Mike Gracia, Washington.
And for some perspective on all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Russell Stone, American University professor emeritus and former director of the Center for Israel Studies.
Well, it's a decision by President Trump, and it was done apparently without much consultation with his foreign affairs and Middle East experts. Most observers point out that there is both a short-run and a long-run implication of this. In the short run, cutting the funding so drastically, up to 40% of the total support for UNRWA, could lead to unrest that could result in anti-Israel demonstrations, that could result in even stimulating terrorist actions. In the longer run, the implication of this is to call into question the whole idea of the status of Palestinian refugees 70 years later. That refugee status has existed more than 70 years, which means the actual refugees, many of them are 70 or over. There was a second wave of refugees after the 67 war, but even that is more than 50 years. And the question is, A, how many generations can consider themselves to be refugees and to have a right to international support for their refugee status? And secondly, what the nature of that support needs to be. The dependent population has grown from perhaps 600 to 700,000 to over 2.5 million. The total people claiming to be refugees is between 5 and 6 million. The discrepancy is that many are resettled elsewhere, and whether they still qualify for refugee status revolves around the question of the right of return, where no Palestinian refugees are willing to give up the principle of the right to return to their homes.
The agency's commissioner rejected the notion that the agency is perpetuating the crisis of refugees, saying that what is needed is a political solution, which is the political leaders in the region have failed to do.
Well, they're both true. The dependency is being fostered. The leaders are refusing to move toward a solution, and that it does perpetuate the situation.
What about the U.S. contention that the agency is irredeemably flawed?
Well, the nature of the support needs to be called into question. It's the only separate refugee agency supported by the United Nations. There is a United Nations High Commission for Refugees that deals with all refugee questions around the world, except for Palestinian refugees that have their own agency, the UNRWA. So whether this is a valid and viable arrangement or one that needs to be called into question is what is being highlighted by the current crisis.
Well, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu on Sunday welcomed the U.S. decision. He said the funding that's being withheld now by the U.S. should be used to generally help rehabilitate refugees. He says while Israel has brought in Jews from all over the world, Palestinians have yet to find a final home.
Yeah, well, that's very true. How it could be used in Netanyahu's view is to somehow eliminate the right to return and have a global effort to resettle Palestinian refugees elsewhere.
Is the real issue of the right of return for hundreds of thousands of Palestinians displaced since 48 and 67?
In terms of their bargaining position, the political position, absolutely.
Yeah.
In terms of whether it's a realistic hope, that's something that would need to be negotiated.
So this obviously complicates what is already an extremely difficult Mideast peace process.
Well, it shakes it up, just as the recognition of Jerusalem as the capital by the United States has shaken it up in the past months. This strategy of shaking things up and seeing what will come loose. Is apparently a diplomatic strategy of Trump's that he's doing as a wild card. He's doing it on his own.
Dr. Russell Stone, American University Professor Emeritus, former director of the Center for Israel Studies. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. In Bangladesh, two-thirds of all girls are married before the age of 18, depriving many of them of their childhood and others the right to an education. A U.S.-based nonprofit organization is trying to change that by providing educational support through a program called Girls Education Program. But as Veena Mupti reports, the support is also coming from everyday citizens, like a mother and her 9-year-old daughter.
When Sasha Forbes heard an interview with the founder of Speak Up for the Poor, she was moved and inspired by their mission.
I'm very passionate about empowering girls and empowering women.
The U.S.-based nonprofit does a lot of work in Bangladesh, one of the poorest countries in the world. Troy Anderson is the founder and international director of Speak Up.
So in Bangladesh, the major problem there is child marriage, where up to two-thirds of the girls are married before the age of 18. And quite a lot of those are getting married when they're 13 or 14 years old. So we're working on the preventative side to keep girls in school so that they won't be forced into illegal marriages when they're young.
The Girls Education Program provides extracurricular support, such as daily tutoring, books, school supplies, and educational seminars. About 1,300 girls from 30 villages in rural Bangladesh are currently enrolled in the program, with hundreds more on the waiting list. They rely on sponsors like the Forbes family to help them finish school. But after a year sponsoring a 12-year-old girl in Khulna, the third largest city in Bangladesh, the 39-year-old mother decided to go the extra mile and took along her 9-year-old daughter, Maya, to visit the young girl they were helping.
I wanted her to be able to relate with a young girl on the other side of the world and to get that perspective and know that not everybody lives the type of life or experience that we have. And then also, I wanted her to know that if she felt passionate about something and she wanted to make a difference or volunteer, it's very possible.
For 2 weeks, the pair volunteered their time to work in various villages in Khulna. They spent time with their sponsored girl, visited classrooms, brought presents and school supplies, and taught English lessons to dozens of young girls. For Maya, the experience was a valuable lesson in compassion.
I basically learned that no matter how much stuff you have, no matter how educated you are, that inside everyone's basically the same person.
After returning to the U.S., the mother-daughter duo continued to speak up for the poor, raising money through yard sales, benefit workouts, even lemonade stands. They hope to bring the donations back to Bangladesh in November. Their efforts have inspired others like Wendy Zenders to support their cause.
Not everybody can go out into the mission field, but we can support people that do. So I may not be able to, you know, pack up my bags and take time off from work and go to Bangladesh, but because she has that passion to do so, we can support her financially or whatever it is that she needs. We can help pitch in and help with the fundraising events or whatever it is that she needs.
With the help of groups like Speak Up for the Poor, Forbes and her daughter Maya are making a difference in the lives of many. Through their efforts, many more young girls are getting the chance to learn so they can follow their own paths to success. From Washington, D.C., Fina Mubtadi, VOA News.
In the English Channel, French and British fishing vessels have clashed in a dispute over scallop fishing rights. VOA's Lori London talks with it about all of that with Paris-based journalist Catherine Field.
The area in the north of France, right on that English Channel, is got just really some of the richest scallop beds in the world. Now, these scallops are really a delicacy in France. There are restrictions on how much can be fished each year, and there are restrictions on the length of time each year when French fishermen can go out and get these very precious scallops. So French fishermen are only allowed to be in the waters fishing from October through to May. The idea is that this period from May to the 1st of October allows the stocks to be preserved, to give it all a rest. So on that aspect, the French say, we're helping to preserve these very precious stocks. And on top of that, they say that these are almost like family fishermen that go out there. They say that in this fleet, there are around 300 fishing boats, and that's about 1,200 families depend on these fish. So it's a really very small industry. However, British boats aren't fishermen. They're not constrained by these French laws. They can go and fish any time of the year they want. And what the French are saying is that they're not just fishing. They are plundering these stocks. They are using huge dredging nets, and that they are dredging along the bottom of the English Channel, and they're just churning it up, and they're taking away far more stocks than they really need to take away. So that's the problem. Now, earlier this week, one French fishing communities had started to hear that these big boats, British boats, were out there in the channel and they were fishing. They decided to go and tell them what they thought of this. And once they got there, these very, very small French boats, about 35 of them, surrounded the English vessels, threw stones at them, threw flares, and even rammed some of the boats.
Wow.
Now, everyone thought that was going to be it, but apparently local authorities there fear that there are more of these clashes to come, and that the authorities up there, particularly the marine authorities in northern France, have put all of their policemen and Coast Guard on alert.
Now, are there limits there on how much they are allowed to fish or haul?
For the French, there are. There's various limits depending on the size of the boat. Now, the French vessels are generally between 15 and 20 meters long. The ones that are coming from Britain are 30 meters long. So these are much bigger vessels, and they're not constrained at all by any of the laws on how much they can fish. So they go any time, they dig it up, and they just literally, as the French would say, they are hoovering up this precious catch. The British say, look, laws are laws, we're obeying the law, and they are now accusing the French fishermen of just being pirates and treating that part of the English Channel as though it's their own, and they say it's not.
Are the main concerns that they feel this is an issue of greed, or are there environmental concerns?
Mostly it is to do with greed, and also the fact that they feel that the British vessels are coming in just when the French can't go in. They're saying, look, yes, there is this period between May and October, the French aren't allowed to fish, and the British vessels should respect that as well. When it comes to the environment, yes, there is this question of size and the method that these British fishermen are using when they fish. This dredging, these huge big vessels with this dredging tackle and the fishing and freezing equipment, so they can, in some cases, take up enough scallops in perhaps in one day that a local fisherman would bring in over a month. So the environmental side is essentially that. It's unsustainable fishing. However, that having been said, the scallops are not in any danger. They're not being overfished. But really, the French say, just for a couple of months each year, they should be just allowed to just grow and just preserve stock.
Now, has this been a problem for a while? Why are we just hearing about it now?
It has been an issue for decades, really. Even back in 2012, there were similar clashes like this in the English Channel, boats ramming one another and rocks being thrown. The problem is that when it comes to fisheries and the amount of fishing that can be done, this is all agreed at national level, and it's not a European-level decision on how much can be fished. So while ever there are national quotas, other boats can come along, a British boat can go into French waters and fish what it thinks it can. So whatever that it is just at national level and not international agreements on certain areas, we are going to have these quotas systems only being adhered to by one side, and these types of disputes are liable to continue.
That's Catherine Field. She is a Paris-based journalist and speaking with my colleague, Lori London. Well, scientists are using a new way to track animal species without having to capture them. It's through a process called environmental DNA, and scientists can now obtain the genetic trail animals leave behind, which could help to protect and save threatened species. More now from VOA's Deborah Block.
Scientist Mark Stokel is throwing a bucket into New York's East River to learn more about the fish that live there. But he's not trying to catch fish. He's hoping to gather the tiny bits of DNA fish leave behind. Then he puts the water into plastic bottles for a closer look in the lab for what he calls environmental DNA.
We can collect the water sample, analyze the DNA, learn what fish are there.
Stokel and his students are trying to find out if the fish are recovering in the East River, which used to be extremely polluted. In the water, they find scales and skin cells, which leave behind genetic material.
Cup of water, you get what looks like a little bit of dust in the water. We extract that DNA, and then we analyze it the same way they do for a crime scene.
On the other side of the world, in a river in Vietnam, the hunt is on for the Yangtze soft-shell turtle, a very rare species found only in parts of Asia.
We can be able to use environmental DNA as a forensic tool when we can't see animals, or if they're very elusive species. We can use capturing environmental DNA to be able to determine if those species live in a particular area.
Especially in unexplored waterways.
So that we could hopefully find additional undiscovered Yangtze giant softshell turtles to be able to help recover the species from the brink of extinction.
Knowing the microscopic trail animals leave behind may someday help scientists save other endangered animals from extinction. Deborah Block, VOA News.
And this is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers have spotted and imaged the brightest object found so far in the ancient universe. The dazzling object is a quasar called P35215, and it's nearly 13 billion light years from Earth. This means the universe was only about 800 million years old when the light from this object started heading toward our planet. To make their discovery, the astronomers used the National Science Foundation's Very Long Baseline Array of telescopes. The astronomers say that the ancient quasar is split into three major components, which are spread over an area that's only 5,000 light years wide. A quasar is formed when the gravitational pull of a supermassive black hole devours material so quickly it discharges very bright and energetic jets of particles traveling at nearly the speed of light. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. So good to have you with us today. Guess what? It's time now for a little something from the world of music.
Walk on through the wind. It'll be over after a while. Walk on through the rain. Though your dreams be tossed.
Gladys Knight, known as the Empress of Soul, was one of the many who paid tributes to superstar soul singer Aretha Franklin, known as the Queen of Soul, whose funeral was held Friday in the U.S. city of Detroit, Michigan, where she died on August 16th from complications of pancreatic cancer. Gladys Knight also spoke fondly of her longtime friend.
We all should be about trying to make it better, whether it's the world, whether it's a person, you know, those kinds of things. And that's who she was. I mean, and I wish that people could pick that up from her.
American singer, songwriter, record producer, and multi-instrumentalist Stevie Wonder also honored one of his idols, Aretha, whom he described as a true exponent of love.
Yes, we can talk about all the things that are wrong, and there are many. But the only thing that can deliver us is love. And if we love God, then we know truly it is our love that will make all things better. When we make love great again, that is what Aretha said throughout her life. Through the pain, she gave us the joy and said, let's make love great again.
Stevie Wonder also said he was so proud to have known Aretha and to be mentored by her. And it was an ever so emotional moment at the funeral when Stevie sang, for Aretha, I'll be loving you always.
Shape evolving, and the rosebud found to bloom in early May. Since hate knows love's cure, you can rest your mind and sure that I'll be loving you always. Cause now I can't reveal the mystery of tomorrow, but in passing we'll grow older every day.
Stevie Wonder was a child prodigy, considered to be one of the most critically and commercially successful music performers of the late 20th century. Wonder signed with Motown's Tamla label at the age of 11, and he continued performing and recording for Motown until not long ago. Motown got its start in Detroit, not only Aretha's hometown, but Stevie's as well. One of Stevie's early hits for Motown in 1969 was My Cherie Amour. Stevie Wonder went blind since shortly after birth in 1950, but he never let that stop him from writing and performing songs that captured the love of generations of fans. He received 25 Grammy Awards, one of the most awarded male solo artists of all time, and has sold more than 100 million records worldwide. Celebrating the birth of his daughter, Aisha, Stevie's song, Isn't She Lovely, is one of his fans' favorites.
Isn't she lovely? Isn't she wonderful? Isn't she precious? Listen for me, dear. I never thought your love would be making one as lovely as she. Isn't she lovely,
dear? Really love this song. It was 17 months ago that my daughter was born. And on that very day, we played this song on my wife's phone for the wee tot. And then on her first birthday, we played his version of Happy Birthday. If you haven't heard it, you gotta check it out. Hey, listen, everyone. Thanks for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. Latest world news is straight ahead. We hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Monday. Now some more from Stevie Wonder.
An editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the first Monday of September every year, the United States pauses to honor its workers and the contributions they make to our nation's prosperity. On September 5th, 1882, more than 10,000 men and women paraded through the streets of Manhattan to celebrate the first Labor Day. New York's Central Labor Union organized the day of celebration in honor of the workers who fought to secure higher wages, shorter hours, and better working conditions for laborers. It was a day of celebration, but also a day of sacrifice. The workers sacrificed that day's wages to demonstrate their commitment to gaining fair compensation for hard work. American workers transformed the United States and the world with a quality of life never seen in history. American farmers export more food than any country in the world and produce food more efficiently per capita than China and India, the world's largest food producers. The United States exports more refined petroleum than any other country in the world, and it exports more than 40% of the world's spacecraft and aircraft and more than 11% of the world's electronics. America has the largest road network of any country in the world, with over 6.5 million kilometers of road. 90% of American households own at least one automobile, and American workers produce almost 3 million cars per year, nearly 5% of cars produced per year worldwide. A key element in America's economic success is the freedom that every American enjoys, the freedom to choose their work, the freedom to innovate and create new industries and revitalize old ones. "What we are witnessing today is the renewal of the American spirit," said President Donald Trump. "Our allies will find that America is once again ready to lead. All the nations of the world, friend or foe, will find that America is strong, America is proud, and America is free. We do not seek to impose our way of life on anyone, but rather to let it shine," said President Trump. "We will shine as an example for everyone to follow."
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
This is